Listening test. Part 1. You're going to listen to a recorded material. Before you listen, you have 20 seconds to read instructions carefully, and you'll listen to it twice.
Hello and welcome to Mind to Mind. Today my guests are Professors Julia Ford and Stuart Cameron, who are researching human memory. Julia, tell us about your work.
Well, basically we're investigating the relationship between individual memory and shared memory or social memory. And particularly we're looking at how reliable our memory is when it's shared. So memory researchers have mostly focused on individuals remembering alone. But in everyday life, we probably as often remember with other people, with our family, our friends, and the people we work with. In cognitive psychology, memory researchers have been very worried about the influence of other people on our memories and assessing that.
They worry that we're going to influence or infect one another's memories, particularly in the forensic setting, like if someone's a witness to a crime. And that's understandable because we don't want people who are giving testimony, for instance, to report things that they didn't experience, that they just picked up from other people.
But even so, you know, we don't think that worry necessarily has to extend to all the kinds of memory that we use. And when we look at our everyday interactions, it's actually helpful when we look to other people to help us remember.
Stuart, you've observed many older couples telling their stories and performing various memory tasks. What did you find?
It was quite interesting because I was quite ideological in a way about the research, and I thought we would definitely see that everybody collaborated really well and showed strong benefits of socially shared remembering. And in fact, we didn't see that. What was really interesting was that some couples collaborated really effectively and performed much better when they were together than when they were apart. And other couples disrupted each other and didn't remember together effectively, at least on certain tasks. So these anomalies became the thing to explain. And what I did was look at the processes that occurred while they discussed and while they shared remembering. So we recorded the conversations and we coded each phrase that was said for what it contained. And we looked for what kinds of ways of interacting with each other predicted memory performance.
And we found when they were sharing memories that some couples could cue each other really effectively in quite novel and idiosyncratic ways. So sometimes they would say, I know about tools, you know about clothes.
Or you remember the first half and I'll remember the second half.
Right. So they'd split it up according to their understanding of each other's expertise. Although with tasks where one person was definitely the expert on the whole thing and the other wasn't, that really hampered successful collaboration because the job tended to be all offloaded onto one person. And so having a lot of shared experiences and a lot of shared history seemed to be helpful.
Yeah. We saw more successful collaboration in tasks where their expertise was perceived as more shared and more distributed.
You know, we're kind of unlike other animals in the extent to which it's part of our nature to rely on objects, technologies, and the social world as well. Of course, we're always in danger of losing things, of our technologies being destroyed or, you know, losing touch with other people. We're kind of hostage to fortune compared to other animals, but that's just how we work.
And finally, a question for both of you. There's also the possibility that our brains are changing the way they operate, the way the memory works. Could that be a problem?
It can be a problem, absolutely. I mean, from a scientific and philosophical point of view, I suppose it's more immediately just fascinating to try and observe cultural changes in the kinds of technologies and objects that people have access to and ignore the need for hard facts.
I'm certainly interested in the social nature of memory from the time that we started to draw paintings on the walls of caves. And I know Stuart is investigating our contemporary reliance on artefacts, technologies and so on.
Yes, although it's a controversial theory, the role of civilization is embedded in our view. It means over time and in different places and contexts, human memory actually changes, not just its support, but in its nature as well.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Hello and welcome to Mind. Today my guests are Professors Julia Ford and Stuart Cameron, who are researching human memory. Julia, tell us about your work.
Well, basically we're investigating the relationship between individual memory and shared memory or social memory. And particularly we're looking at how reliable our memory is when it's shared. So memory researchers have mostly focused on individuals remembering alone. But in everyday life, we probably as often remember with other people, with our family, our friends, and the people we work with. In cognitive psychology, memory researchers have been very worried about the influence of other people on our memories and assessing that.
They worry that we're going to influence or infect one another's memories, particularly in the forensic setting, like if someone's a witness to a crime. And that's understandable because we don't want people who are giving testimony, for instance, to report things that they didn't experience, that they just picked up from other people.
But even so, you know, we don't think that worry necessarily has to extend to all the kinds of memory that we use. And when we look at our everyday interactions, it's actually helpful when we look to other people to help us remember.
Stuart, you've observed many older couples telling their stories and performing various memory tasks. What did you find?
It was quite interesting because I was quite ideological in a way about the research, and I thought we would definitely see that everybody collaborated really well and showed strong benefits of socially shared remembering. And in fact, we didn't see that. What was really interesting was that some couples collaborated really effectively and performed much better when they were together than when they were apart. And other couples disrupted each other and didn't remember together effectively, at least on certain tasks. So these anomalies became the thing to explain. And what I did was look at the processes that occurred while they discussed and while they shared remembering. So we recorded the conversations and we coded each phrase that was said for what it contained. And we looked for what kinds of ways of interacting with each other predicted memory performance.
And we found when they were sharing memories that some couples could cue each other really effectively in quite novel and idiosyncratic ways. So sometimes they would say, I know about tools, you know about clothes.
Or you remember the first half and I'll remember the second half.
Right. So they'd split it up according to their understanding of each other's expertise. Although with tasks where one person was definitely the expert on the whole thing and the other wasn't, that really hampered successful collaboration because the job tended to be all offloaded onto one person. And so having a lot of shared experiences and a lot of shared history seemed to be helpful.
Yeah. We saw more successful collaboration in tasks where their expertise was perceived as more shared and more distributed.
You know, we're kind of unlike other animals in the extent to which it's part of our nature to rely on objects, technologies, and the social world as well. Of course, we're always in danger of losing things, of our technologies being destroyed or, you know, losing touch with other people. We're kind of hostage to fortune compared to other animals, but that's just how we work.
And finally, a question for both of you. There's also the possibility that our brains are changing the way they operate, the way the memory works. Could that be a problem?
It can be a problem, absolutely. I mean, from a scientific and philosophical point of view, I suppose it's more immediately just fascinating to try and observe cultural changes in the kinds of technologies and objects that people have access to and ignore the need for hard facts.
I'm certainly interested in the social nature of memory from the time that we started to draw paintings on the walls of caves. And I know Stuart is investigating our contemporary reliance on artefacts, technologies and so on.
Yes, although it's a controversial theory, the role of civilization is embedded in our view. It means over time and in different places and contexts, human memory actually changes, not just its support, but in its nature as well.
Part 2. You're going to listen to another recorded material. Again, before you listen, you have 20 seconds to read the instructions carefully, and you will listen to it twice. You're ready to start.
What if you could use genetic engineering to stop humanity's most dangerous predator? The deadliest animal on the planet, responsible for the death of billions, the mighty mosquito. Along with other diseases, it plays host to malaria, one of the cruelest parasites on Earth, possibly the single biggest killer of humans in history. A new technology could help us eradicate malaria forever. But to do so, we need to engineer a whole animal population. Should we use the technology? And is malaria bad enough to risk it? Malaria is caused by a group of microorganisms, Plasmodia. Very weird microorganisms that consist of just a single cell. Malaria always starts with an insect bite. In its salivary glands, thousands of sporozoites wait until the insect penetrates your skin. Immediately after invading you, they head for the liver, where they quietly enter big cells and hide from the immune system. For up to a month, they stay here in stealth mode, consuming the cells alive and changing into their next form, small, drop-like merozoites. They multiply, generating thousands of themselves, and then burst out of the cells. So thousands of parasites head into the bloodstream to look for their next victims, red blood cells. To stay unnoticed, they wrap themselves in the membranes of the cells they killed. They now violently attack red blood cells, multiplying inside them until they burst, then finding more red blood cells, and this cycle repeats over and over. The mosquito is the perfect carrier for human diseases. They've been around for at least 200 million years. They are practically impossible to eradicate and the perfect parasite taxi. But today we have new revolutionary technology that could enable us to finally win the war against them. CRISPR. For the first time in human history, we have the tools to make fast, large-scale changes to entire species, changing their genetic information as we please. Using genetic engineering, scientists successfully created a strain of mosquitoes that are immune to the malaria parasite by adding a new antibody gene that specifically targets Plasmodium. These mosquitoes will never spread malaria. But just changing genetic information is not enough. The edits would only be inherited by half the offspring because most genes have two versions inside the genome as a failsafe. So after just two generations, at most only half of the offspring would carry the engineered gene. In a population of billions of mosquitoes, they would hardly make a difference. A genetic engineering method called the gene drive solves this problem. It forces the new gene to become dominant in the following generations, overpowering the old gene almost completely. Thanks to this twist, 99.5% of all the engineered mosquitoes' offspring will carry the anti-malaria edit. If we were to release enough engineered mosquitoes into the wild to mate with normal mosquitoes, the malaria-blocking genes would spread extremely quickly. As the new gene becomes a permanent feature of the mosquito population, Plasmodium would lose its home base. Scientists hoped that the change would be so fast that they could not adapt to it quickly enough. Malaria could virtually disappear. If you take into account that nearly 500,000 children are killed by it every year, some scientists argue that we should use the technology sooner rather than later.
Now you will hear the recording again.
What if you could use genetic engineering to stop humanity's most dangerous predator? The deadliest animal on the planet, responsible for the death of billions, the mighty mosquito. Along with other diseases, it plays host to malaria, one of the cruelest parasites on Earth, possibly the single biggest killer of humans in history. A new technology could help us eradicate malaria forever. But to do so, we need to engineer a whole animal population. Should we use the technology? And is malaria bad enough to risk it? Malaria is caused by a group of microorganisms, Plasmodia. Very weird microorganisms that consist of just a single cell. Malaria always starts with an insect bite. In its salivary glands, thousands of sporozoites wait until the insect penetrates your skin. Immediately after invading you, they head for the liver, where they quietly enter big cells and hide from the immune system. For up to a month, they stay here in stealth mode, consuming the cells alive and changing into their next form, small, drop-like merozoites. They multiply, generating thousands of themselves, and then burst out of the cells. So thousands of parasites head into the bloodstream to look for their next victims, red blood cells. To stay unnoticed, they wrap themselves in the membranes of the cells they killed. They now violently attack red blood cells, multiplying inside them until they burst, then finding more red blood cells, and this cycle repeats over and over. The mosquito is the perfect carrier for human diseases. They've been around for at least 200 million years. They are practically impossible to eradicate and the perfect parasite taxi. But today we have new revolutionary technology that could enable us to finally win the war against them. CRISPR. For the first time in human history, we have the tools to make fast, large-scale changes to entire species, changing their genetic information as we please. Using genetic engineering, scientists successfully created a strain of mosquitoes that are immune to the malaria parasite by adding a new antibody gene that specifically targets Plasmodium. These mosquitoes will never spread malaria. But just changing genetic information is not enough. The edits would only be inherited by half the offspring because most genes have two versions inside the genome as a failsafe. So after just two generations, at most only half of the offspring would carry the engineered gene. In a population of billions of mosquitoes, they would hardly make a difference. A genetic engineering method called the gene drive solves this problem. It forces the new gene to become dominant in the following generations, overpowering the old gene almost completely. Thanks to this twist, 99.5% of all the engineered mosquitoes' offspring will carry the anti-malaria edit. If we were to release enough engineered mosquitoes into the wild to mate with normal mosquitoes, the malaria-blocking genes would spread extremely quickly. As the new gene becomes a permanent feature of the mosquito population, Plasmodium would lose its home base. Scientists hoped that the change would be so fast that they could not adapt to it quickly enough. Malaria could virtually disappear. If you take into account that nearly 500,000 children are killed by it every year, some scientists argue that we should use the technology sooner rather than later.
Part 3. You also have 20 seconds to read the instructions before you listen. And you will also listen to it twice. You're ready to start.
A NASA spacecraft is set to make history today, getting closer to the sun than any other heat object. The Parker Solar Probe must survive the radiation and extreme temperatures it will encounter to solve some of the mysteries about our star. Well, our science editor Rebecca Morell has more.
Our sun, in all its fiery splendour. We've been studying it for centuries, but there's still so much we don't know about it. Now, the closest ever encounter is set to finally shed light on our star. NASA's Parker Solar Probe blasted off in 2018, heading to the centre of our solar system. It's been orbiting our star, getting ever nearer, but this latest flyby is taking us to a new frontier, to touch the sun.
Even though we've had missions that have gone very close to the sun, that wasn't close enough to get into this sort of magic region where all of this physics and all of these processes that are happening, and the only way to be able to understand those processes is to fly through them and take the data right where all the action is happening.
This mission is breaking records. Parker Solar Probe hurtles past the sun at 430,000 miles an hour. No human-made object has ever gone so fast. It's the equivalent of flying from London to New York in less than 30 seconds. At its closest, it's 3.8 million miles, 6.2 million kilometres from our star's surface. That's closer than any other spacecraft. It will have to endure scorching temperatures of 1,400 degrees Celsius as it passes through the sun's corona, and this could solve a long-standing mystery.
The corona is really, really hot, and we have no idea why. So the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees or so, but the corona, this tenuous outer atmosphere that you can see during solar eclipses, that reaches millions of degrees, and that is further away from the sun. So how is that atmosphere getting hotter?
The mission is also studying the solar wind, the constant stream of charged particles bursting out from the sun's corona. The probes even recorded the sounds of the sun, three different types of solar wind. Dispersive chirping waves, Langmuir waves, and Doctor Who-like Whistler mode waves. When these particles interact with the Earth's magnetic field, the sky lights up with dazzling auroras.
But this space weather can cause problems too, knocking out power grids, electronics and communication systems. The hope is the mission can help us to better understand this. But first, the spacecraft has to survive its burning hot flyby. Rebecca Morrell, BBC News.
My goodness, extraordinary story. Let's talk to Dr. Jennifer Millard, astronomer and managing editor at software company Fifth Star Labs. What kind of information do we hope it will bring back?
This probe is going to tell us about the sun's magnetic field in very close proximity to the sun, part which we've never been able to explore before. And we don't understand how the magnetic field of the sun is created. We don't know where it comes from. And we don't understand how these charged particles start almost stationary on the surface of the sun. And then they're accelerated to 1,000,000 miles per hour. And we need to understand this because they make up space weather. And space weather impacts our life on Earth. A really strong solar storm, when we have a big explosion of material on the surface of the sun that barrels towards Earth, well, that can even knock out some of our satellites. It can pose a danger to astronauts in space as well. So understanding the sun and how it works is absolutely vital for modern life.
And if we, once we get that kind of understanding, I mean, obviously there's no controlling of these solar flares, these winds, but what will that information mean logically for us in terms of those satellites, GPS and everything else you've described?
Well, it means we'll be able to make forecasts. So like we can predict the weather on Earth, it would be amazing if we could forecast space weather and say, OK, we know that there's going to be a storm in 3 days. Which satellites might it impact? Let's put them into safe mode. Maybe we can move their orbits, move them out of the way. We can get astronauts into more sheltered parts of space stations. Or if they're on deep space missions, we can give them warning. Because, you know, we're moving into the era now of not just sending astronauts to the moon, which is what we're hoping to do with Project Artemis. But in the next couple of decades, we're looking to send astronauts to Mars. And on that sort of journey, you know, you're 8 months in space, there is going to be a solar flare. Something is going to hit you. And we need to give those astronauts as much warning as we can to make sure that they're protected. So having that ability to predict these storms would be essential.
So a lot riding on this little probe. No pressure there. Dr. Jennifer Millard, astronomer and also from the Fifth Star Labs software company. Thank you very much for talking us through it.
Now you'll hear the recording again.
A NASA spacecraft is set to make history today, getting closer to the sun than any other huge object. The Parker Solar Probe must survive the radiation and extreme temperatures it will encounter to solve some of the mysteries about our star. Well, our science editor Rebecca Morrell has more.
Our sun, in all its fiery splendour. We've been studying it for centuries, but there's still so much we don't know about it. Now, the closest ever encounter is set to finally shed light on our star. NASA's Parker Solar Probe blasted off in 2018, heading to the centre of our solar system. It's been orbiting our star, getting ever nearer, but this latest flyby is taking us to a new frontier, to touch the sun.
Even though we've had missions that have gone very close to the sun, that wasn't close enough to get into this sort of magic region where all of this physics and all of these processes that are happening, and the only way to be able to understand those processes is to fly through them and take the data right where all the action is happening.
This mission is breaking records. Parker Solar Probe hurtles past the sun at 430,000 miles an hour. No human-made object has ever gone so fast. It's the equivalent of flying from London to New York in less than 30 seconds. At its closest, it's 3.8 million miles, 6.2 million kilometres from our star's surface. That's closer than any other spacecraft. It will have to endure scorching temperatures of 1,400 degrees Celsius as it passes through the sun's corona, and this could solve a long-standing mystery.
The corona is really, really hot, and we have no idea why. So the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees or so, but the corona, this tenuous outer atmosphere that you can see during solar eclipses, that reaches millions of degrees, and that is further away from the sun. So how is that atmosphere getting hotter?
The mission is also studying the solar wind, the constant stream of charged particles bursting out from the sun's corona. The probes even recorded the sounds of the sun, three different types of solar wind. Dispersive chirping waves, Langmuir waves and Doctor Who-like Whistler mode waves. When these particles interact with the Earth's magnetic field, the sky lights up with dazzling auroras. But this space weather can cause problems too, knocking out power grids, electronics and communication systems. The hope is the mission can help us to better understand this. But first, the spacecraft has to survive its burning hot flyby. Rebecca Morrell, BBC News.
My goodness, extraordinary story. Let's talk to Dr. Jennifer Millard, astronomer and managing editor at software company Fifth Star Labs. What kind of information do we hope it will bring back?
This probe is going to tell us about the sun's magnetic field in very close proximity to the sun, part which we've never been able to explore before. And we don't understand how the magnetic field of the sun is created. We don't know where it comes from. And we don't understand how these charged particles start almost stationary on the surface of the sun. And then they're accelerated to 1,000,000 miles per hour. And we need to understand this because they make up space weather. And space weather impacts our life on Earth. A really strong solar storm, when we have a big explosion of material on the surface of the sun that barrels towards Earth, well, that can even knock out some of our satellites. It can pose a danger to astronauts in space as well. So understanding the sun and how it works is absolutely vital for modern life.
And if we, once we get that kind of understanding, I mean, obviously there's no controlling of these solar flares, these winds, but what will that information mean logically for us in terms of those satellites, GPS and everything else you've described?
Well, it means we'll be able to make forecasts. So like we can predict the weather on Earth, it would be amazing if we could forecast space weather and say, OK, we know that there's going to be a storm in 3 days. Which satellites might it impact? Let's put them into safe mode. Maybe we can move their orbits, move them out of the way. We can get astronauts into more sheltered parts of space stations. Or if they're on deep space missions, we can give them warning. Because, you know, we're moving into the era now of not just sending astronauts to the moon, which is what we're hoping to do with Project Artemis. But in the next couple of decades, we're looking to send astronauts to Mars. And on that sort of journey, you know, you're 8 months in space. There is going to be a solar flare. Something is going to hit you. And we need to give those astronauts as much warning as we can to make sure that they're protected. So having that ability to predict these storms would be essential.
So a lot riding on this little probe. No pressure there. Dr. Jennifer Millard, astronomer and also from the Fifth Star Lab software company. Thank you very much for talking us through it.
That's the end of the listening section. You now have 2 minutes to check all your answers.